We are back, Underground Espionage, episode 25. And Tara, I'm very excited. Are you very excited?
I am very excited, Mike.
Well, we are excited because today, Underground movie maverick Tim Ritter is joining us for a discussion. We're going to talk about your history throughout the world of underground movies. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You started way back in the day at a very young age in the early 80s in Florida. Tell us about what movies made you want to start making your own.
Well, I mean, as a little kid, I naturally just kind of wrote little books and staple them together. And my mom encouraged me to be pretty creative. And I think Dark Shadows, Hammer movies, Star Trek, all that kind of, paved the way for my interest in creating and movies. And I think it was probably Jaws and Halloween as they came out on television that really inspired me to the point where I was had already grabbed the family Super 8 movie camera. And I had been in my neighbor was my babysitter, Joel D. Weinkoop, and he was making Super 8 movies. And I ended up being in some of his movies. And I was like, you know what? I want to make movies. And it was like probably whenever The Incredible Melting Man came out, that trailer with the 16 millimeter or the $6 million man and the 16 millimeter look and just the whole thing of the astronaut melting and all that kind of stuff, that really just also inspired me. So those key moments, along with just a passion for the Super 8 camera, got me into movie making probably by 1976, 77. And, by 78, I was probably churning out, my little 4-minute, movies based on movies that I love. So that's how it kind of all began.
That's so incredible. And, you do mention that your babysitter was Joel, who will eventually be a big collaborator with you throughout the years.
Right.
And just one of the great underground actor, creators, directors, writers, just a force of nature.
Right.
How early did you guys bond on movies? When he was your babysitter, were you guys watching movies together, or was it something that you guys ended up connecting on a little bit later?
Like I said, he was doing a movie called The Bionic Boy, and he corralled my dad into driving a car, and I was just a little kid at the time, and I got to play a bad guy. So, and then he would draw up Spider-Man comics and sell them for like a quarter. And Joel still does comics. As a matter of fact, he just had one come out, and I would buy those and I would read them. And, so everything he was doing, I just was already gravitating into. And of course, it helped kind of fuel the fires. Later, he moved away, and then we reconnected probably in 1984 when I was in high school. I made Day of the Reaper, my first feature-length Super 8 movie, and I was transferring it to videotape, and we were selling it to local independent stores. And Joel's nephew Terry saw the ad in the newspaper, the War Cry, which was Jupiter High School's newspaper. That's where my big ad campaign started. I was like, I'm going to take out an ad in the school newspaper to sell this movie. And Terry gave it to Joel, and then Joel called me up right away. And I had just gotten back from seeing The Terminator, and we just picked up right where we left off. And I go, yeah, I just made a movie. And Joel was excited. He goes, I want to act. I want to help you sell this movie that you've made. And everything just kind of went off from there. So,
amazing. And what's also amazing is you are wearing a Terminator shirt right now.
Right. So yeah. That's kind of ironic.
Ends. Yes.
it never ends. And if anybody wants to witness Joel's incredible acting abilities, not only in the many Tim Ritter movies that he's in, but you have to see Lost Faith, one of the most insane, incredible shot on video
summer
movies
of all time.
As a matter of fact, Joel was just in Maryland, and they had a sold out theatrical showing of it last week, and it was like $50-$60 a person for, I guess, something called So Bad It's Good. But he said the crowd went crazy and he just felt really good about it, and all the people loved it, and he sold tons of t-shirts and VHS and DVD. I mean, who knew 35, 40 years later that these movies would be, kind of at a status that we had hoped for when we started.
Well, I want to talk about that because, well, first of all, I'm glad that he's getting the recognition, especially at film festival like that. Even if that is the name of the festival, good for you guys for putting on a festival. But I think that we all would agree that the idea of so bad it's good is not something that we subscribe
Right.
to because
No,
we
yeah,
don't
that
think
is
these
yeah,
movies.
that is a whatever the group was, they put on like two shows a year with, and
Which
that's
is
their
great. It's
focus.
great, but we always say when we talk about movies here that, to me, a bad movie is a boring, generally major giant movie that's just is I
A
have
waste of
zero
money and
interest.
Time. Right. $100 million down the drain.
Saving Reaper is a great movie. Lost Faith is a great movie.
Right. Well,
But
thank you.
oh, absolutely. And we want to go through your history, but just because you brought it up now, when did you start seeing this big resurgence in these reissues, Blu-ray, the treatments, the extras, these deluxe slip cases? And when did it start getting on your radar that, oh, these movies are getting a third, fourth, fifth life, and this might even be the biggest they've been since even coming out?
You're very right, and I started to notice a resurgence when I discovered some VHS tapes of Wicked Games, probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, and I started putting them up on eBay, and they were going for $100, $150, and I was like going, and I ended up making finally the whole budget broke even, just finally selling, and they were shrink wrapped and they were great. And then at that point, I've always had a good relationship and a good, distributor deal with SRS Cinema. But at that time, I forget. I remember I was working a security job and I used to read the Wall Street Journal. I had read about Vinegar Syndrome when they were restoring adult movies, and they were based out of I think Connecticut. And I was like, wow, this sounds like a very interesting company. And they were getting into the old H.G. Lewis movies, and of course, some horror that was kind of borderline, just exploitation. And then as that grew, and I want to say it's probably like 8 years ago, 9 years ago, it's not clear, but I had no idea that VHS, Super VHS would be able to be upscaled and go on the new format and all these Earl Kessler smash hit boxes and all that as the way it's gone and as the way we've seen. But it's been very lucrative and very good for exposure, and a very pretty big surprise. So
It's really exciting, companies like Vinegar Syndrome and then the sub labels like Saturn's Core, of course, doing just so much of the 90s stuff, Wave and all that stuff.
right,
And
yeah, I was su so surprised to see Wave stuff coming out, and I guess it sold out, so I was like going, wow.
no, there's a rabid audience for this stuff. I think more so now than ever, especially looking back to these times where there was all these limitations and the limitations of the technology and what you guys did to plow through those limitations. Let's go back to Day of the Reaper. Super 8. You were in high school. And so how old were you when you made Day of the Reaper?
I think I was 15 when we developed it, and then I think I just started driving. So you needed a driver's license at 16, and the green van you see in Day of the Reaper that the lead character drives, that was the van I learned on, and that was the van that we traipsed around in when we shot it down in South Florida. So I had to have been just turned 16.
And
Incredible.
that van, did it have air conditioning?
No, it's kind of like the chainsaw van. It was an old GMC, and it had lots of space though for all our props and people. I could go around and pick up, all the actors and actresses. So
Amazing. Yeah, I
phenomenal.
want something, especially in a lot of the behind the scenes stuff with many of your movies, especially shot in Florida, the heat is talked about a lot and how hot a
Yes.
lot of these shoots are, especially in the summer, I'm sure, because you're probably doing it during summer break, or were you doing it on the weekends? When did you film Day of the Reaper?
That was on summer break. So, like Killing Spree, that was sh shot in the summer of 87 when it was really hot. And I remember I did a movie for Kevin Lindemuth called The Ransom for Alien Agenda, which should be coming out on Blu-ray from Wild Eye at some point. And not only did I get softball-sized boils or whatever from the back of my legs from the sun, the camera actually melted in the car. So
My
the heat down
God.
there was unbelievable. So.
Oh,
Yeah,
insane.
and I think that's part of it that we get so inspired by is that, especially in your youth, you start so many projects but so rarely finish them. But you had the wherewithal to keep going and work through the boils and the melting tape and whatever else is happening in Florida and keep going with it.
That's very true. I always had a motto: to make a movie, you have to become a movie, and it's just the focus is just that. I really didn't haven't ever had anything else other than writing and movie making. So there was just that tunnel vision, like I'm gonna finish this no matter what I
That's that it's so inspiring. And how did the casting go about? How did you get people to agree to be in this movie? And then how long were you filming with some of the actors and actresses? Was it a couple days? Was it a couple weeks? How did the actual filming go and
Well,
casting?
for Day of the Reaper, we cast through. I went through the Jupiter High School drama department, and then I even drew the drama teacher into Twisted Illusions when we filmed that the following year. He played a part in the Capricorn Network, and he ended up in Truth or Dare Critical Madness as the lead psychiatrist. So, but we cast through the high school mainly, the drama department. And I'm just trying to think. I think that was, and there was a lot of it was just friends or people we knew or people from journalism class. And then my cousin Joe Pruth came down and he manned the camera, did the photography, and that was pretty much the size of the casting. And it actually took all summer on and off. Joe Pruth and I washed dishes and we saved our extra money to actually shoot as we went, and we would get props. As a matter of fact, the Reaper uniform was our dishwasher uniform, the rubber boots, the apron. We spray painted it red, and it was like, hey, let's put a black cloak over him. He's a bad guy. So it was all just kind of came about, and we did shoot probably from July all the way, and I remember finishing in October because we had some cast changes, the usual changes, people that couldn't make it, had to rewrite the script for somebody else and combine roles and all that kind of thing because of just casting and people going on vacation and changes. So we finished in October and then we edited in that October. And then by then, whenever Terminator came out, I was had already transferred the film to Betamaster and was making VHS dubs and trying to put them. And as a matter of fact, that's original cover here. I just happen to have it. The original cover was just slid into the box, and we went around and sold these. And that's when Joel called and invited himself to help me sell. And that was great because he's a much better salesman than I was or ever will be, because he also worked for he had lots of sales jobs for his regular job. So he was really good at going in and talking to people and going, hey, this is a locally made movie and blah blah blah. So I learned a lot from him selling the movie. So he was definitely a great asset in that too.
That's so awesome. And you are in this movie more than many of your other movies. Was that a replacement, or did you want to play the detective in Day of the Reaper?
Oh, I'm a huge Dirty Harry fan, as you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wanted to play it, and plus, it was just, I think I paid people a little bit, like $10 or whatever, and then of course there's food, so I figured
Yeah.
I was already there. I'll save a little bit of money, and I'll just jump into the role. So.
Perfect. And what's amazing is that a 16-year-old in 1984 looks more like a 27-year-old. You literally, it is amazing. Like, you don't actually look like you're in high school watching it now
Yes. Yeah, that's
compared to what
funny.
a 16-year-old would look
Yes.
like now.
Yeah, I think that's how I was able to get Truth or Dare finance, because I guess I appeared a lot older than I was. So if they would have known I was like 17, 18, they probably would have been like, get this kid out of here. He's just a dishwasher.
It's amazing. And so when you're doing the, obviously with Super 8, you're filming it and then you do the sound over it after filming it. How did that process go, and how did you even learn how to do that at such a young age? Like, how did you know how to do the overdubs and stuff like that?
It was just trial by error, and that movie is very erroneous to me because I use cassette tapes. I changed the dialogue when we, I'm sure you've noticed the sound is way out of sync on that. But then as I was doing
Yes,
it,
it's amazing. It's great.
pieces had come out, and I was like, well, it's out on there. I'm just making a homage to pieces, you know. So, but I'm saying something different, and we forgot what we said, and it was just you know, having a ghetto blaster and recording the dialogue while we watched it, and then playing it back, and of course that didn't sync. So there's a couple scenes that are synced in it, and then the rest of it is just kind of way off. And then I hooked up with Sean Ruddy, who composed the music, and he was just actually this record store dude, and I would hang out on Moondog Music, and I'd buy soundtracks and heavy metal albums. And we just, you know, he was the clerk behind the counter, and he was always recommending stuff. And I was always like, hey, can you special order Halloween from Japan? I think it's on vinyl there. And he was all excited about that. And when I finally told him, I go, oh, I make little movies too. He goes, oh, you know what? I'm, you know, a composer working at a record store. So that's how we kind of collaborated on that. And that was just really awesome because all my Super 8 movies before that were just scored with my soundtrack collection. So here's Sean Ruddy going, I'll do original music for you. And then to see him set up his synthesizers and his keyboards and all that in his living room while we watched the movie, and he composed that crazy score was just that to me, I was like, man, I'm headed for Hollywood here.
It is so amazing. On our rewatch last night leading up to this interview, we were re-blown away by the score.
100%.
It is so crazy, but also it is something that does make the movie, especially looking back on it now, are those how the dubbing's off and how things aren't lining up. It does give this unintentional dream surreal quality when you're watching it. It is that thing in the dream where someone says something, but wait, I don't think they said it came out of this person's mouth over here, and then all of a sudden the Reaper's over here in the forest, but then you're over here, and then you know, just like it so it
It's
does
like a
add to that.
sweaty fever dream, and you can
Yeah.
hear
Right,
Steve Brown who's saying
dude.
what,
It's
but that's the charm and joy of it, though.
absolutely. Yeah. And so once you get all that together, then you knew that you're gonna dump this down to beta and just start dubbing everything yourself.
Yes, I had like two or three VCRs. I would rent VCRs from the local mom and pop stores and connect them all together and try to do three or four copies at once. And then Joel and I, once we had probably about 25 copies, we put them in the trunk of the car or the van or whatever it was, and we'd drive around and you know, hit all the stores up and give our spiel. It'd be like, hey, we're local movie makers. We got this. We think you can rent this out and make a lot of money. And you know, we started to do pretty good with it. So
So, do you recall about how many you made of that first run? Oh, after the first 25, I mean, how many did you
oh
continue?
yeah, I think, I mean, all in all, I think we did a couple hundred. And eventually, along with Twisted Illusions, we connected with the Van Guys. And the Van Guys, I just did a podcast not long ago where the big discussion was the Van Guys. The Van Guys were pretty much used tape brokers who would drive from independent store to independent store in their pickup trucks or vans or whatever they were. And they would operate out of a warehouse or, you know, just a small place. And they would sell used tapes, adult tapes, and B movies and exploitation movies. And 30-day-old studio movies that were a lot cheaper because, of course, as you remember, probably from knowing all this, the they were about $100 per copy. A month or two later, used, you could buy more and have breadth of copy, and you know, they'd be $40. So these guys would go around and trade, and so I got, you know, we got Twisted Illusions in that, and then Day of the Reaper got into that. And those guys also would go all along the East Coast from Florida all the way to New York. So copies of our stuff started to trickle out into other states. So that was kind of a really wild time, you know.
What a system.
Yeah. These days, you just put it up on YouTube and you Potentially, you can have worldwide distribution. Anybody, from anywhere can watch it. But back then, it was like, hey, we passed the Macon County line with this movie. Look at that. All right.
Yeah, but that's the underground spirit that you've had your entire
Yeah.
career, and just hearing that, I mean, this is exactly what we love. Just these people doing it true DIY, do it yourself.
Well, that explains a lot, actually, because I always wondered, being I'm from Kentucky, and so I always wondered how my local video stores in various places would get these strange films. Like I remember, renting Pigs in a really rural area, even down to like trauma stuff, and like where did they get it? What was the impetus? Because they certainly didn't care about it. So it must be van guys going
It
through
could have
the
been. Could have
rural
been. Yeah, or
communities.
little
Or
cheap guys.
something like a van guys,
Right.
yeah.
The little indie guys going around, or and they're just kind of just selling used tapes and they're making a living out of it. So
It's so awesome. And
yeah.
so you did mention Pieces, a favorite movie of ours. What were some other movies that you were aware of in that vein that you were like, oh, I don't need to have $1 million and major studio funding to make a movie. I can make these movies. There's movies that are strange, done in this very odd underground way. What other movies aside from Pieces were you aware of at the time?
Oh wow, back then of course some of the Italian movies, the Dario Argento started to get their rated R releases. Of course Pink Flamingos, John Waters, Herschel Gordon Lewis. I had the book The Amazing World of Herschel Gordon Lewis, and that's where I got the distribution idea was, him and his partner David Friedman would make these movies and then go to the drive-ins with the films and hand deliver those, and they would show them, and if they did well they'd take them to somewhere else. Hey, we're going to Texas this weekend, we're going here and there. So that whole thing was, I had the same idea. I was like, you can do this with video stores. I felt I was too young and I was going to miss that window of opportunity. Somehow I knew that window of opportunity would not last once the studios took over. Just instinctively, I was like, there's just going to be a limited time. So that's why I was kind of hell-bent on starting in, 1984, even while I was still in high school. I could not graduate fast enough to get my work seen. It was really strange.
Dude, that's so sick. And quickly after Day of the Reaper, you were going to pick up a camcorder, or I don't really actually know the exact thing you guys used to make Twisted Illusions, but how did that come about? And Twisted Illusions, if anyone hasn't seen, is a anthology in the vein of a creep show. Some short shorts that you and Joel put together. What made you think about that you could do this on video as opposed to film?
Well, the first thing I was transfixed on was sync sound. I was like, oh, the dialogue will match the lips. But I think in the process of selling Day of the Reaper, Joel and I ran into a guy named Al Nicolosi, who, like Sean Ruddy, was doing the counter at a video store, Video Xtron. And he also worked at Channel 12, which was a TV station. And he wanted to make movies. So, and then from there, we met Vincent Miranda, who worked on Shockwaves and other movies. And he's the one that told me that I'd won the Worst Cop Actor Award at some early film festival for Day of the Reaper. And I was like,
Awesome.
oh, really? That's great. I was
Yeah.
terrible. I was like, what an honor. But I think Al Nicolosi was the one, like, hey, I have all this video equipment. And I ended up learning a ton from Al because he ended up getting a video production company and I got to work with the equipment. He had the equipment. We also had it at school. So at that point, it was just a no-brainer. We shoot right on video. I don't have to develop film and all that expense. Then Al taught me how to edit. He showed me the edit boards. And I think it was in the early editing days, we went down to a place in Lantana and it was $30 an hour to sit there and edit Twisted Illusion. So compared to today, who would pay $30 an hour to edit anything? They'd be like, going, are you out of your mind? So that's how it all started. And suddenly I knew video was the way to shoot. And then that's And the anthology idea was kind of a mix between Creepshow and Twilight Zone with absolutely no money. So
Yeah, well, yeah, no.
yeah.
Yeah. And I know that it's when things got released back then is up for debate, because around that same time, Blood Cult, there's Sledgehammer, whatever is considered some of the very first shot on video movies. You're in that conversation.
Right.
That one is.
Right.
And there's
Well, again,
Boarding
I
House, but
have
oh
this
yeah,
is
oh, there it
I
is.
just happen to have a copy. This was Twisted Illusion,
Ah,
and we
amazing.
didn't even have
That's
the
great.
I didn't even get the ones with sleeves, you know, the
Yeah.
actual cases. So, and this one somehow survived. It's got mailing tape, and I just did mailing tape, and this was our label.
Oh
Oh,
my
dude,
God.
amazing. The label was
Yes.
just a
That is
regular.
beautiful.
Wow. So that's
Absolutely.
how we distributed it. And I was just like, oh, we got the wrong cases, put mailing tape on it. And we went around and, you know, did that. And same way as with Day of the Reaper. And then we you know, got connected with those van guys, and that's how they went from state to state. So
So amazing. And then were you aware of Blood Cult and Sledgehammer and Boarding House around that time, or was that maybe even a little later you discovered them?
I did read Fangoria, so
Yeah.
yes.
Oh,
Blood
there you go. Of
Cult,
course.
yeah, Blood Cult was everywhere, and I was racing to beat that, believe it or not. Now, Twisted Illusions came out in January 1985, I think. Blood Cult, and then by then I was already had written Everybody Liked the Segment in Twisted Illusions, Truth or Dare, which was a short. They liked that the best when we would show it around, and the feedback on that was phenomenal. So I developed that into a feature length script. And at that time, when Blood Cult was announced, I was trying to get Truth or Dare to be the first made for video movie. I wanted all the, but they beat me to the punch. But I mean, I was working on it, and then it got stalled, and then we ended up shooting on 16mm. But it was all in that year, 1985, when all that went on. Blood Cult, I'd heard of, and of course they raced into what, the Ripper, and then they raced into Revenge and Terror of Ten Killer and all those. So I was very aware of those, and those were pretty prominent at that time. But then when all those were coming out, you know, there I was with Truth or Dare, and that finally came out in June 1986 was when that came out. So
Well,
yeah.
truly a classic, one that you'll always be known for. I mean, I'm sure when you were making it at the time, who would have thought that in 2025 you were going to be on a computer talking to two people across the
Right.
country
About
and
these movies still.
going over all this stuff? But Truth or Dare is a true classic. You were 18 when you directed it and wrote it.
17 and then
17,
turning
18.
18. Yeah.
And yeah, it is shot on 16, and it was funded by a company. So how did this happen? How did you get the funding from Peerless? That's the name of the company, if I'm not mistaken.
That is
And
correct.
the go ahead, the green light to, at 18 years old, helm your own movie.
Right. Actually, I graduated high school. I was 17 when I graduated that summer, and by then I had the whole script done. I had bought script writing books, and again, the van guys played into it because the van guys also worked with other van guys, and as they were expanding our movies, Day of the Reaper and Twisted Illusion. So you see how one thing kind of leads to another. They went to a company called VSI, which was Video Swap International, based out of Northbrook, Illinois. And they were van guys. They had started in the basement, and they had this huge company, and they dealt in a lot of adult titles, new and used titles, and they were making millions in the video business at that time. They also wanted to get into direct-to-video movies, and they had released a movie called Vegetable House, which was a comedy, and they were also distributing, believe it or not, 555. Somewhere they had bought some copies of that, and they were experimenting with that. And when I came to them with Twisted Illusions, they bought a few, and they go, "Well, the quality's not the greatest on this, but we'll try to move some for you. But we're very interested in what you're doing next." And then Al Nicolosi and I jumped on that, and through the summer of 1985, we ended up negotiating, and it kept stalling, and it was, yeah, we're gonna do it, we're gonna not do it. Finally, they said, next time you're in the area, stop by the office. And I was like, in the area, I'm down here in, near Fort Lauderdale, and they're up in Northbrook, Illinois. So Al Nicolosi and I just said, okay, we're going to buy tickets. We're going to go up there and we're going to go talk to them. And we packed our briefcases and they picked us up in a limousine, a pink limousine, believe it or not. And we went up and started negotiating with them. Jeffrey Miller was the owner of the company. And that's where he made Peerless Films into some sort of company. From his company, a subdivision, so they could produce movies. And that's how Peerless Films evolved with Twisted Illusions Incorporated. Because then once they were on board, I had to incorporate. And, we did that. And from there, everything was kind of put together.
And what was it like for you now you've done two movies and obviously your early home movies with friends, local people, but now you're stepping into working with actors and casting people that you might not know already or from the area. And you're dealing with adults that you are now working with. How did that dynamic work for you?
I was actually already doing that. I would, Al Nicolosi and Joel were both probably 6 to 10
Well,
years
there you go. Yeah, I
older
guess
than
that's
me.
true.
So I was already dealing with adults. And then I ran into another lady, a local casting lady named Roberta McElroy. And she was casting for movies, plays, and Miami Vice and all those kind of shows. So, and then there was another lady named Priscilla Duff who also was doing casting. So I naturally just gravitated to them and they had headshots. They had, they go, oh, all you need to do is an office or a hotel room or a convention center, rent a little room in there. And so we were already, the intent was Truth or Dare Critical Madness for my pitch for VSI was, hey, we're going to shoot it on Beta SP, just like Blood Cult. We wanted $60,000. We had Mike Maddy, special makeup effects man who worked on Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter. Later, he did Scanners 2. We had him committed, and I'd gotten him through other connections through a guy named Jack Starr, who I somehow connected with, some heavy metal guy, and he knew him. So everything was just outside of high school and washing dishes and working my little job, everything was movie oriented. And I was just making all these weird connections and it just seemed, very natural. So we'd already done the casting before I sent a tape. As a matter of fact, Al Nicolosi and I made a financing videotape where we showed hundreds of applicants that we were already looking at. And we had the guys from Miami Vice helping us. As a matter of fact, a lot of the people in Truth or Dare Critical Madness were in Miami Vice. Mary Fanaro, the lead, was Crockett's wife on season 5, believe it or not. So it was just me. That was what was happening in South Florida.
Amazing. It's amazing. We do believe that because we have the Miami Vice box set sitting
Big
right
fans.
over there.
So yeah, look at season 5 or what the last season she did end up playing his wife. Then she ended up doing on Any Given Sunday with the Oliver Stone movie. So
Wow.
and Truth or Dare, Critical Madness, say the full title. A lot of times I say Truth or Dare, but I don't want anyone to think we're talking about the Madonna movie, which is great too. But there is a real melancholy, haunted somberness to this movie that you would not expect an 18-year-old's first major movie to be. Was that in your head when you're writing this, or is it just something that end up coming out when you're making it? Because it's not, it doesn't open with some crazy kill, and it really builds slowly, and the music is very
You
somber.
have like a depressive midlife crisis feel to it.
Yeah, and you were
Right.
18. So how what do you recall what you were thinking when you were writing it and building this movie?
I guess I've always kind of had a lot of depression, and it was just my way of kind of dealing with that through art cathartically. And, I'd had no relationships at that point that I was even drawing from, but a lot of rejection at that point. So that was all channeled. Then you have all these raging hormones as a teenager, and you're like, what do I do with all this? So it all kind of channeled into this. Everybody was shocked on the set when they met me. There's, like you said, there's this young guy who looks like he's in his like 20s. They're like, man, I thought you'd be some 50-year-old dude that was in 5 marriages and coming out of therapy. And I was like, going, well, maybe I should be in
He's like, I can't shoot every other weekend. I got to see my
Right.
kids.
I'm seeing Dr. Phil right now. But yeah, it all just kind of ended up in there. And you know, I was just kind of, you know, of course, everybody growing up has very depressed periods. And then you add in the, you know, some of the metal music like Quiet Riot, Love's a Bitch, and all that kind of stuff. It all just kind of absorbs in there. And it just kind of came out. And as a matter of fact, I remember when I was doing rewrites, the one producer was like, he offered me some kind of drugs, and I was like, oh no, I think I had like Motley Crue going. I was like, no, I don't need anything. I have this music here, and that's all that fuels me, that and coffee. So
Oh, that's
Leave all the
amazing.
drugs for Motley Crue.
Yeah,
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sure they used them.
Yeah, no, and even the music in it, you know, there is some pounding synth stuff during some of the more aggressive scenes, but it opens with this just really sad music when Mike, the main character, you know, finds his wife cheating on him, and he's driving to the beach. That area of the beach and that walkway that I feel like has made its way into multiple Tim Ritter movies, and just staring out at the ocean and just him reflecting back on his wife cheating on him. It's like it's you would be not you would be surprised possibly if you just threw that movie on that this was going to turn into one of the craziest horror
Bloodbath.
movies.
This is just Floridian melancholy.
And so it really is this inc it is it's such a unique movie. And again, I think that does go to it being, you know, your first major movie, being so young that you take these moves and these turns in a movie that maybe someone who's done more wouldn't think to, or someone who is a little more quote unquote professional wouldn't think to do, especially as the rampage picks up where a baby is run over in a stroller, a little leaguer is chainsawed, and
Oh,
it
wait, isn't
continues
that
from there.
Baby Duff? Was that the casting
Right,
agent's
as
child?
the casting director put her newborn kid, and she wants to be an actress.
I had to look at the credits for that. I was like, who's the casting director? Baby Duff.
Yeah,
Duff. Perfect.
Priscilla Duff. Yep,
It clicked.
I mean, that baby's probably 40, 45 years old
Dude,
now.
got a
Amazing.
credit right off the bat.
Right.
Yeah, no, but it really is, and the 16 millimeter adds to the look of it, and just this very haunting look that's really unlike other movies of the time that would have had a bigger budget, which are great too. You know, we love, you know, especially 80s horror stuff, all levels of it, but something like Truth or Dare has this very distinct haunting quality that I think as the years go on is even more so and connects with people more. And like I said, I'm sure you've seen that. You see new kids discovering that movie as the years go on that you're like, you know, you're younger than I was when we made that movie, and now you're discovering this for the first time. And
It's delivered with an earnestness at the pain behind what was happening. You
yes,
know, like it's
that's
like they're earnestly hurting, and it fuels the rage, which is
right.
what
Yeah,
we lack sometimes.
and that's something, especially with D both Day of the Reaper and Truth or Dare, is that there isn't a the things aren't taken as a joke. You're delivering this in a very non-ironic way, which I think really adds to it, especially nowadays when so much stuff is steeped in irony. And so the lasting effect is huge. The mask in the first one is incredible. We really love the first mask. Again, it'll go on to become a little more elaborate, a little more metallic.
But yeah, that frowning
The
face.
copper.
Again, it's this
So good.
depressive, like it has this really somber quality. Who designed that mask, and then how was it made? Obviously, the effects guy made that.
The original mask was made by Bill Koeffler, and I think he'd worked on, I want to say, one of those Boggy Creek type movies, and you know, he had a few credits like that, and he came from like Alabama, and with his effects crew, and he created that mask based on, you know, the script, of course, and I was inspired by the I guess Bang Your Head, Quiet Riot, mask, you know, with all those crazy videos with I always thought that's a copper mask for some reason. I was like, yeah, my killer is gonna have one of those. And then for the sequels, Joel Harlow, who I worked with on Killing Spree, and is now an Academy Award winning artist, he made the really grilled look updated version for that, which we've kind of stuck with until part five, where Scott Tepperman had half a mask because his character is the kid that was chainsawed in the original movie. He's got the chainsaw damage and he covers it up with half a frowning face and a copper mask.
It
So
looks great though.
yeah,
That I
it
mean
does.
that one looks great and really, and they all look great in their own way, but there is some of that first one that again is there's this real just sadness to it, and just the whole that the whole arc of that movie of going into the institution, getting let out, killing, going back. I mean, it
Going
has
back in,
this
right,
strange like
and
flow that
that's the
again.
sign of the times then and
Yeah.
now, where
Yeah.
people go in and go out
Out.
and
Yeah, it holds
go
up. Yeah,
out.
exactly.
Yeah.
100%.
Did you the explosions?
Right.
We've been so curious. Like, did you conduct the demolition, the explosives?
Were there
Or was it,
permits?
or were
What?
there permits
How did? Yeah,
involved?
like.
How legit were these explosions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the explosions were by an effects team, Bob Shelley and Jerry Barry. They'd done Code of Silence. They've done all the team that worked on Death Wish and Ghostbusters, and so they were kind of bigger Hollywood guys. And but they're still around, and they're based out of Georgia, in Atlanta, Georgia, and they go all over the place. And but yeah, we had to have insurance. And they, were magicians with that stuff. And the producer's actually the one who knew them, Yale Wilson. And he said, let's add some explosions into this. I was like, oh, okay, no problem.
Okay.
But yeah, the one funny story about that is, though, they kept changing where we were going to do those gags. And when you see the car run into the telephone pole, or actually, we thought it was a telephone pole, but it was an electrical pole. And you see that arcing where the electrical box blew up. That was the mayor lived in that of North Palm Beach, lived in that housing development and lost their power because of us, because we didn't really. And that was pretty scary when that thing went off and it blew the transformer when it hit the pole. So that was unexpected. But being involved with the stunts, it was pretty scary. But beforehand, we do everything with little Hot Wheels cars and cardboard with the lanes and everything. We'd go this car, but it's a science, but it's also there's also a margin for error in that, which makes those guys very dangerous and very you've got to have roll bars, you got to have the flame gel and all that stuff because it's very risky.
It's insane, and again, it's like so impressive thinking about you doing this, and especially when the dude's on fire. I mean, that shot's on there for a while. I mean, getting
That was
shot,
one
and
of the
yeah.
it was one of the first fire burns with that gel for full body, because before, as you know probably from watching endless B movies, they looked like they were in an astronaut suit sometimes. You're coming out and it was like, going, that guy changed clothes or was he driving a motorbike? But this was the time when you could just put a thin layer on you, and then and Savini later went on, like David Letterman, and he put a little bit in his hand. And I don't know if you caught that for Chainsaw 2, where his hand, it's on YouTube now, but he would do all these effects and show David Letterman, about the latest effects gags. But that's, we actually were one of the first to use that on that shoot.
Oh, it's so cool. And I am sure, being a big fan of the burning, you were excited to do a Burning Man scene.
Oh yeah,
I
all
mean,
that stuff. And you mentioned the music earlier, and that was done by the guys that were from Earth, Wind, and Fire. So Johnny
oh,
Britt and
really?
Ken Carlson. So they did a great job
Critical
on,
Madness? Great
yeah, the
song.
music, all
They
that
did
stuff.
that song. Love it.
They did the song and all the music.
Scuba!
So
So, of course, we had to ask you about the song, of course. Once you watch it and you go, stick through the credits, you will be singing the song Critical
right. We'll
Madness.
wake up at
Critical
3 a.m.
Madness. Yeah,
with it in your head.
but again,
Right.
it's not what you would expect an
Exactly.
18-year-old making a slasher horror movie. It's not Alice Cooper, he's back, or it's not, the metal and the
Right.
cursed demons. It is this smooth, like, I don't
Smooth
even know.
balladish. Well, and it was a Sunday school teacher, and her choir at church was actually the ones they used for
Amazing.
that. So,
And I was like, how do they get
amazing.
children singing on this? How?
It was just. Everybody was really into it. I remember when I guess it was Ken Carlson came up with the song and he sang a demo of it. We had the cassette, and all me and the producers and all of us were just playing that, running on the road when he had rented a convertible and he was blasting it through the air. And he was like, "Critical Madness is going to be the biggest hit of all time." And I was like, thinking, "Okay, all right."
So you finished the movie, and it was always planned to be direct to video, correct?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So okay. So now, were there any screenings when it came out, even locally at the time, or?
Oh yeah, there was they had a big premiere at the Chicago Limelight facility. I didn't get to go to that, but they said a lot of porn stars were there, and then Truth or
Oh.
Dare t-shirts showed up in a Ron Jeremy movie, believe it or not. And I never did see the movie, but I was always like, I'd like to see
You know,
that because some.
we'll do the research and try to find out
Yeah,
where.
see if you can find
Yeah,
out
fact check.
which movie that everybody wore the Truth or Dare, because they all went to the Truth or Dare premiere, and I guess they were giving out t-shirts. But then there was what premiere in Florida, and then in Japan there was these. Back then, there was like video kiosk booths or something like that, where you could go in a booth in a video store and watch the movie. So it was pretty big in that too. So whatever that was, and it was released on 8mm videotape and LaserDisc, VHS, and Beta at the time. So
You have a copy of
all the
each of all the
formats.
formats?
I've moved a lot since then. I think I have a Beta and a VHS, and I never did get the 8mm.
That'd be so cool. It would just be so cool to have this
It's like,
era.
oh, here it is.
Yeah. Oh, that would be so cool. And so it was, immediately it's getting out there, and it's doing really well. And especially that's the time video stores are just going nuts, so many mom and pop stores. And so it's really getting out there. That must have just been just so exciting for you.
It was, yeah, it felt like, I'd hit big time, and we
Yep.
did. For the time, 30,000 copies went
Dude.
out to independent video stores over a period of a year, which is
Wow.
phenomenal. Because I ended up working at a video store years later, and you figure out a new title goes out, especially smaller titles with a cool cover, it would rent out every day almost for years. So you multiply that times how many. It's way more than streaming was. Millions of people got to see that movie back then,
So cool, and just cool to think about something we talk about a lot with movies and with music, especially back then. We grew up in the 80s, and obviously we were in high school in the 90s, but when you had to go rent the movie, or you bought the record or the tape or the CD, or you bought a copy of the movie, sometimes your collection was 10 movies, and the rentals was this whatever the store had, but then you'd rent that movie so many times, or those handful of movies that you got your hands on that you did buy, you'd watch them over and over. So your relationship with those movies are so much stronger than maybe that you stream a movie once, or you stream it and maybe you go, you're also looking at your phone, like that kind of stuff again.
They're less disposable because you're stuck with them. It's like you're taking a shot, you're taking a chance, and even going to rent things, we would be, like, what's the weirdest thing I can find? You know what I mean? Like having no idea, and you could get really disappointed, or you could get really shocked. And so that was always kind of like the gem. Like I would imagine
And
taking a
you had to
chance.
watch it too, because you had to take the
Yes.
tape back. You're like going, well, I'm committed to this.
Yeah. And then even sometimes stuff that maybe didn't hit you the first time, there'd be something that stuck with you, like, man, that one movie that we that my I was at my buddy's and we watched like 2 years ago, that I keep thinking about it, so I'm gonna go back and watch it.
Yeah, I
Like
thought it was boring,
just
but now I don't.
these
Yeah.
relationships with that kind of stuff. Again, it's wonderful that things are that you can get things immediately, and if again someone listening to this who hasn't seen your movies, you can pretty much through between streaming services, between buying the Blu-rays, between ex renting on streaming services, you can watch most of your movies. And that's awesome. And I encourage anyone who's listening who has not seen these movies to go do that immediately. But there's something to be said for, going to the store, renting it, sitting with it. Maybe, oh, I bought a copy for, like you said, back in the day, if you were to buy a new copy, those were expensive. Now it's
A hundred
ridiculous,
dollars.
too. Yeah, I worked for Blockbuster as well as an independent video store. When I worked for the independent video store, I would go to the warehouse to get the new movies sometimes, you know. And yeah, I was like, oh my God, this is like, you know, this is $89 for, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's just how it was.
I think the first movies I bought, because I was lucky enough to get a Beta VCR in my bedroom in like 1983, because I passed algebra, believe it or not. And I went,
Hey.
I got brought, my mom bribed me. She's like, well, we'll get you one of those if you pass. But I remember buying Basket Case and Pieces for like
Amazing.
$80, you know, in the summer of 83 and 84. And I was like, going, I have to have these. I have to have these.
And then you probably watched them over and over
Over and over and
because
over,
you had them and that's what
definitely.
you had and that was your. And yeah, so that and getting into the intricacies of those movies is something that, you know, we love, we still love to do, but especially back then when we were first discovering movies at the video store, there's something that can't be replaced, you know, with that experience that we all had growing up. And you're gonna have some distribution problems coming up here shortly because your next movie, Killing Spree. I was shocked that this wasn't immediately picked up. That when I went back and watched the documentaries and was reading about it later, especially in this wonderful issue of Draculina number 19, you talk about this. I was shocked that this movie didn't get picked up because to me, it was perfect for home video. It is just a great splatter slasher. It's just immediately watchable fun,
Sexy and
yeah, like
Right.
and
Right.
everything. Totally insane.
Yeah.
How did something like Killing Spree not get picked up by distributors? What was going on at that time that it just wasn't an immediate grab for somebody?
Oh, well, thank you for the compliments. But I think what happens was, of course, commerce and art. First, you're focusing on the art of creating it and getting your vision done as best as you can. And then you have investors to deal with, and investors wanted X amount of dollars back. They wanted an advance. And at that time, and I think when we finished, there was a in 1987, I remember we finished the movie, and there was a real big stock market crash, and like dominoes, the independent video scene changed because Vestron and all Lightning Video and all those subsidiaries were having problems. Trans World, the whole market changed. Lightning, you know, all those put they suddenly they weren't giving the advances. They were much more selective because they were all on the way out. So we couldn't get, I think at the time we were shooting for, you know, like $50,000 up front or something like that. And we just couldn't get it. So when you couldn't get the amount that the investors wanted, just like today, where you got big companies that are like, you know, we made a profit, but it's not what our projections were. So it wasn't that they wouldn't take it, but they wouldn't give us what the investors wanted at the time, and which was a very big struggle for myself. So that's kind of what took so long. And then eventually, when the actual companies that would offer something were well below, you know, what the expectation was. So it got really frustrating, you know, trying to get it out there and also, you know, pacify the people who were, you know, monetarily involved with it. So it became years of negotiations. The movie went through almost every. I have a notebook that I found the other day with just pages and pages of all those old distributors and my notes, everybody from Troma to Trans World to Camp Video, which later released it on DVD, which with its new incarnation from Pop Cinema. But you know, all these people, and then eventually Killing Spree has been released so many times through multiple labels. So we ended up cycling through those eventually over like 20 years of, you know, of all that. But yeah, launching it off was much more difficult. And plus, the movie, as much as, you know, everybody likes it who are like us, production value wise, with the white walls, and there's just a lot of things in it that the people would look at it and go like, you know, this is This is John Waters level, and you're no John Waters, so we don't want this. So it just went on and on, you know.
Asbestos felt.
Tell us about
Come
Asbestus Felt.
on. What a
So
dynamic freak man. Come
how did
on.
you meet him? He makes an appearance in
Yeah.
Truth or Dare, and
Right.
I believe you said that you told him you were going to make a movie for he was going to be the main guy. How
Right.
did you find him, and what was it like working with him on Killing Spree?
Oh man, he was great. He was a great guy behind the scenes, and actually, he was more of a behind the scenes guy. He actually worked with Al Nicolosi, who we met at Video Extron when we were distributing the tapes, and he was a co-worker of Al's, and he did behind the scenes documentaries, Master Control, and all that kind of stuff. And eventually he said, "Hey," and then he got a gig on Truth or Dare. I think he was continuity for a lot of it. And I said, "Hey, you're just wild and crazy. Why don't you play the warty guy that puts a hand grenade in his mouth?" And he was like, "Oh yeah, I'd love that." And he was just excellent to work with. And I think for Killing Spree, he was hard to corral and keep track of because he liked alcohol a lot. So we paid him with scotch, I think, cases. And that was all he got, I think, for the most part. So he stayed at the location and lived there, which was producer Al Nicolosi's house. So, but that was his incentive. It was like, yeah, we'll keep you loaded up here. And but as much as he was intoxicated, inebriated a lot, when it came time to go boom to shoot stuff, he was just completely spot on. So, and he had a blast doing it, and he would pretty much do anything. And he really reminded me of, I guess, David Leary, I think his name is, from the John Waters movies. He just had that kind of look of just this guy that
Yeah.
could do say or do anything, and you'd be kind of afraid of him because you're like, what's he going to say next or do next, you know?
100%.
And that was, you said, the producer Al's house. It was his new house, right? Is that
Brand
why there
new, yeah.
wasn't stuff on the walls? Because that is a strange thing about the movie, is these blank walls. But it's one of
Yeah.
the first things we commented on the first time we ever watched it. But
It's
we
like,
love
wow.
the
We were like,
but
are they
we
renting it? Whose house is
sort
it? You have
of
so many
loved it because it
questions, you
gave
know?
this just,
Yeah. Yeah.
again, it gave that unintentional, just strange, dream, surreal
Right.
feel that,
Yeah.
like, what was the decision to do it in this really weird, newish looking FDS before we knew the
But
background of
people
it?
live like that now. People, we go
Right.
into places, there's
Yeah.
nothing on their walls.
As
It's
you can
just
see,
so confusing.
our wall behind us is crazy. Anyone who's seen our walls knows. And if we
Yeah.
turn the screen around, you're just gonna see insanity. You have all your
Yes,
inspiration
yes.
sitting around you. That's how we live.
Right, definitely.
What was it? Was it just because it was a brand new house that it wasn't decorated, or is that just his style? He just didn't
Yeah,
decorate
that was pretty much the Florida style back
it.
then for a lot of people. They were just like very sparse. They would have a few knickknacks on the shelves, and that was it. Maybe one painting, in the living room, and that was about it.
Oh
So,
man. No, it's incredible.
It's a
And
very modern aesthetic.
you know what? It,
Yes.
you know what? People probably aren't too surprised when they see it nowadays. But Killing Spree is, along with Truth or Critical Madness, it's one that's constantly out there. Like you said, Killing Spree, the Blu-ray that TerrorVision did,
Right.
is, so many people, that's just a staple in so many people's places now.
Yeah.
And again, it's just become one of those movies that, you love recommending somebody, you love showing it to someone because it's just so wild.
Yeah.
That one had that one, whereas Truth or Dare, Critical Madness does have this somber, haunting feel. There is a dark, haunting sadness to Killing Spree, but then it is mixed with Asbestos Felt's over the topness, some of
Right.
the crazy effects, like the infamous giant lips going
Right.
over the head.
Yeah.
So there is a dark humor to it, but it's still different than a dark humor of like a trauma. It doesn't really remind
Yeah.
me of that. There's more of a maniacal humor to this as
Yeah.
opposed to like
That
a
campiness.
goofiness. Like,
Right.
I don't get
Yeah.
goofy from this. I get like, oh, there's a dark maniacalness
Yeah.
to this, which is,
Right. Yeah.
I think
You're
that's what.
absolutely right. Yeah. I took all my horror really seriously.
Yeah, you can tell.
Yeah.
And so, like we said earlier, talking about the seeing this through, plowing through, you're going to start a movie, you're going to finish it. 3 years of trying to get the distribution, trying to get this out there, eventually you're going to dub tapes yourself again, like you were doing. Was there times during this period where you were like, I don't know if I'm going to do another one, or were you always like, I'm getting through this and I'm absolutely going to make more?
Yeah, there were periods where I'd give up and raise the white flag, and then a couple days later, I'd be just start again. So yeah, it was very frustrating and very, very, somber. And you got to have like a really thick skin when it comes to criticism, because it's a movie you made, and then I ended up working in a video store, and you got distributors judging it and sub distributors, and then finally, when I did self distribute it, I was getting the reaction of customers coming back going, I could have made this with my camcorder. I want a refund on that. So it was a very humbling experience. So I saw it from probably every level, from this is great to, my kids do better on this in the backyard. I get a free rental, don't I? Because I would never rent
Oh
this.
my goodness.
Oh
Yeah,
man.
of
Yeah, no,
course.
I'm sure. And just being in it every day like that. But you will eventually get back behind the camera, the video camera,
Yes.
the dreaded high eight camera
Right,
to make
the headed
the sequel to Truth or Dare Critical
Yeah.
Madness, Wicked Games. Had you always wanted to make a sequel? Was it just something that you felt like, oh, people want to see more of this style?
Yes, we had planned. As a matter of fact, the first draft was done before we even rolled cameras on the original. So it was a
Oh, so you were
different
writing your
movie.
doc. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so during that time, they Peerless had planned to do at least two more, but then they ran into distribution problems, money problems, that same thing that I was talking about in 1988. The market changed. The tapes went down in price. You had sell through, so that kind of eliminated the van guys eventually. It was a slow chisel away, because then you could suddenly buy movies for $10 at Kmart or Walmart, or if Walmart was around then.
Yeah.
So everything was kind of changing, and at that point, we just ended up, going from there to see what would happen next. So Wicked Games became the next movie on High Eight.
Dreaded high eight. Now, at this time, like we've been referencing this great issue of Draculina, but there's a whole crew now, that is doing these independent shot on video, 8 millimeter, 16 millimeter in their backyard during winter break in their house in Pennsylvania with their tube socks all the way pulled up. Of course, I'm talking about the Polonia brothers.
Right.
Were you connecting with these filmmakers at that time? And was there a network of you guys trading with each other, communicating with each other, talking to these magazines? How was this crew of underground filmmakers connected back then, and were you connected with these guys?
Right. This was, of course, before the internet. And then when Wicked Games happened, that was probably 92 and 93 is when we started. But yes, at that point, I think through people like, because there was a lot of us doing it, like you said, and I eventually ended up connecting with everyone through alternative cinema, Deep Red, phone calls, and then people like Ron Bonk, who would have who's SRS Cinema's head honcho. He was working with those same guys, and he started up his company, Salt City Home Video, originally in the 90s. And Kevin Lindenmuth, who was a New York City filmmaker, and of course Scooter McRae, and all those people. So eventually we all kind of came together in the pages of alternative cinema, Gore Zone, Fangoria, and Draculina. Hugh Gallagher, of course, he started making movies, and he and I are pretty good friends, and we're always writing or calling each other at the time. And he was like, can I get a magazine article? I want to cover your next movie. And he was distributing, my movies through his magazine. As a matter of fact, it was pretty dry time trying to get B movies out in 94, 95, 96. I mean, Z grade B movies shot on video, because the smaller companies were creating, Cinemax, Skinemax type movies, and pseudo horror slashers, Stripped to Kill, Roger Corman had jumped on the bandwagon. Full Moon Pictures, you had competitors with millions of dollars, or at least half a million. So half a million compared to, $4,000 or whatever is, it's, big difference. And of course, your rental people are going to be much more discriminating, like, I could be doing that with my camcorder type of thing. So it
They
got more
cannot.
difficult. Yeah, right. So it made us kind of go more underground into the alternative cinema and the Draculina area to keep going, So that's how we all connected, was through those magazines, James L. Edwards, J.R. Buchwalter, John Russo, even the famous Night of the Living Dead man had a magazine called Drive-In Cinema, and I got to talk to him quite a bit. And then I was very inspired by Midnight 2, which John Russo and J.R. Buchwalter did. And that's why I said, hey, maybe I'll shoot my next one on video. That everybody's doing it. And then I saw Jack Perez's America's Deadliest Home Video. And that's why I chose Hi8. I was like, that seems like a pretty good, valid format. So that's how all that kind of came together.
In the 80s, it was making stuff and getting out there to video stores, but more of a general audience. You weren't necessarily thinking about it, was just, oh, these are getting into stores. Once we turned into the 90s, now there is a focused audience for these type of movies, and there's a culture of people who want the underground stuff. They want the, like you said, the Z grade. Now they're actually finding the audience more specifically for these movies, as opposed to just a general horror audience.
Right, you got it exactly. And then it became almost like the movie makers were all just sharing our movies with each other. And then when you did find fans, the fans were like us, they wanted to make movies. So
Which
they
is the
were very
best.
right. It was so that part of it was great, but it was also the market was shrinking,
Well,
the
definitely.
audience.
And were you doing the conventions at the time as well? Because those started picking up, like the Chiller Convention. I know Wave Video was predominant in a lot of those. Were you doing any of that?
No, I never really got into those until probably the 2000s, when I started to get asked to come to some. So,
Yeah. I keep referencing the dreaded Hi8 because you have discussed all the problems that it gave you. You said you saw America's Deadliest Home Videos. Oh, this looks like a great thing to
right.
use. And it turns out it wasn't so great. Tell us some of the issues you had making what is just an absolutely incredible shot on video movie. Absolutely. It's very different from it's the original, but stands up on its own in this totally different, otherworldly way. What were some of the problems you had shooting Wicked Games?
Well, of course, special makeup effects. We didn't have money to have people come to the set. So, and Joel Harlow was busy, even though he did the mask. So he connected me with Brad Crisco and Dan Rebert, two partners of his that he had worked with. And they were nice enough to make the material and all the props and all the special effects. But then we would have to, operate them all on the set with our skeleton crew. So, but that it did work. And then, of course, like you said, the Hi8 problem. It was very early in Hi8, so glitches. I would pick up radio frequency Wi-Fi on the audio channels. It's strange tracking problems. Tapes would be eaten. I mean, that just went on and on and on. But this was like very early, Hi8 material. So, and it depended on what kind of tape stock you used, and was it metal or whatever. And I kind of had to learn as I go. And I actually shot the movie two or three times because you'd come back and the tape would get eaten, or you didn't have it, or there was dropouts, or just huge blank spots, on the footage that you'd have to edit around. So that part of it was very frustrating. But of course, later they improved it and then dropped that format. And then the next format was probably Super VHS, Super VHS-C. And then we go into the mini DV. And then now we're at camera cards. So.
Absolutely, but all, not only that, but it's also going back to the analogs. I mean, I know that the recent movie that you were a part of, The Emasculator,
Right.
is that shot on video, right?
Right. This shot on some of the same equipment that we used on Creep and other movies, because Susana Kapisashi and her group of filmmakers love that look and those formats so much that they actually get those cameras and figure out ways to get them going again or record on other decks or whatever. So they have all these wires and stuff to, to other decks while they're filming, but they're actually using the original equipment that we shot Twisted Illusion. As a matter of fact, we're working on Twisted Illusions 3 with Susana, and we're shooting on some of the same cameras we use on the original Twisted Illusions because she's got all those. So
Amazing. And they look great. And
yeah,
you can
they look
tell
great.
how much she and that crew just loves these movies. They
Oh,
look
definitely.
great.
And obviously, it's again, they don't see these as oh, these are bad movies. No, these are great movies that we cherish and we want to work with the same attitude and style that you guys are working with. But with you guys using, when I say you guys again, I'm talking the crew. I'm talking, like you brought up Bookwalter and Joel and Polonius and Phil Herman, et cetera. You guys are using, newer equipment that's available, and you continue to do that. But someone like her, she's like, no, you should have stopped in
Right.
95 and use it. What is your attitude about that now, especially working with her? Are you thinking about also, like you said, Twisted Illusion 3, using some of that stuff? The next time you do something totally as a Tim Ritter helmed project, would you consider using some of that old stuff again?
Yes, definitely, because these newer people really know how to use it. And they do a great job with the lighting, and you don't have the generation down. Whereas before, like if you had a deck to deck, then you have a master to second generation,
Yeah.
and then you go on another generation. They're
Yeah.
recording right onto either first generation mini DV cards and editing digitally, so it looks fantastic. You don't have that terrible fourth generation, VHS look that we had a lot of times when we were distributing back in the 80s and the 90s and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, it's definitely exciting to see. And you do mention Creep. Maybe the peak of your gutterness, I want to say. This is a gutter,
Right.
trashy
We
movie.
watched Creep for breakfast this
We
morning.
did.
Again,
Oh,
complete oatmeal watching
on
Creep.
our
It was
lead up,
great.
anytime
Goes
we're
great
doing.
with
Yes. I
Cheerios.
mean, man,
Starts your day right.
I feel like you, and again, I don't know what when you were making this and writing this, but I just feel like you were like, I'm going for it on this one. This
Yeah.
is gonna have more tits, more blood, more sketchy plot lines, incest and just and necrophilia and everything, Joel digging up his mom and dressing her up. I mean, this,
Right.
you really went for it on this one. And I think maybe that was even, like you said, Hugh Gallagher stuff at the time and around this time, everyone was really pushing those boundaries. Were you going into Creep, kind of going for like, let's just really go for it?
Yeah, the original cut didn't come out till like 1999 because we scaled everything back when we were editing to try to get in the blockbusters and kind of have a pseudo R rating. But the uncut version that came out in 1999 was more of the stuff that like Draculino would run the pictures, and people were like, those scenes are missing from the, and they were, because we were trying to pass pretty much a board of censorship and without a rating. And that's even more difficult than the MPAA going, well, cut this, cut that, this is too bloody, this is. So yeah, I was definitely trying to push the envelope, and I was reading a lot of Jack Ketchum, Richard Lehman, of course Stephen King, and very inspired by all that kind of material. So that's why Creep got pretty rough, story wise.
So, I mean, it's so up our alley in every way. And what's great is on the after the on the extras, there is the current affair clip where they talk about because our main girl, Kathy Willits, was in a prostitution ring scandal with her politician husband. And it was just so great being on the seeing that footage and seeing you on there is so great.
Yeah, that was kind of like my 15 minutes of fame, I guess. Although I had been on like CNN for Truth or Dare Critical Madness because it was covered on shot on video, direct to video movies being kind of like the drive-in. But Current Affair, people wouldn't probably remember that today, but it was kind of like internet scandal, Yahoo type material. A TMZ for today's, people who would tune into that. But those, as you probably remember, those old shows were just, what were they? A Current Affair and Entertainment
Yeah,
Tonight
hard
and
copy.
Hard Copy. And yeah, we were on there with I think Joey Buttafuoco or something. It's like they looped us in with him. But yeah, my whole family watched it, and all the relatives, and they were like, should we be pleased with this? America's
Have
favorite
mixed feelings.
nymphomaniac is teaming up with, but I thought it was great publicity, I thought. So.
It's so great. And yet, like you said, anyone who didn't grow up in this era, those shows were just like my parents, like that would just be on in the living room. Like it wasn't like just people who search out that kind of stuff. It was like the news is on and then that was on and then Siskel and Ebert
It
was on.
was
Like it was
like
just on.
the freak news. Here's the freak news, But yeah, I mean, to me, it was exciting, and we got covered. I think she went on Geraldo, which people probably wouldn't even know what that was today. And Celebrity Sleuth magazine did a big layout with
Amazing.
her on there, and there was a bunch of other magazines and stuff at the time. And now print magazines are, I mean, they're still here, surprisingly, but they're, not everybody that I know reads print magazines anymore. So,
You're not getting your latest news in a print magazine. You gotta wait.
And but what's great is on some of the extras too. I mean, you were featured though on a lot of local news programs, which is so great watching the news anchors like, there's a new movie and it's called
New
Killing Spree, you
movie.
know, like
America's Nymphomaniac had to team up with
and they deliver it because back in the day they're professional news people, so
featuring the local Shakespearean festival. It's
And I
so
like
great.
the one lady says, can you say direct to video?
We were laughing at that so hard.
I was like, yeah.
So
But
funny.
I mean, at the time also there was a huge outrage because it was when the O.J. Simpson thing happened, and one of the newspapers, we had had this photo shoot with Joel and Kathy Willits, and he had the knife to her throat, blonde lady, knife to her throat. And man, people were so mad. I got death threats on my answering machine, and people canceled their subscription to the newspaper, and it got into the public, and everybody was like, had an opinion on it. And I was like, well, it was just bad timing for that publicity,
Or great timing. I don't know. So before we hit record here on this episode, we discovered something that now we knew you were in Lexington, Kentucky nowadays. What we did not realize is that the three of us lived in Lexington for about 4 years together, and somehow I had
Had
no
no
idea in
idea.
my mind it was a recent move and that you were Florida, you know, up till relatively recently. Pushed you to move to Lexington out of Florida, and how did living in Lexington alter the way you make movies?
Pretty much just decided a change of scenery, and my parents had retired up in Kentucky and built a place with land they had inherited from my great grandmother up in Cobb Hill. So I just kind of wanted to experience, a new place, maybe three seasons or 2.5, whatever you have in license to. But yes, of course, starting all over again with movies was very difficult. At first, I just wrote a couple of books. I did two novels, The Hammer Will Fall and Unreal. And then I slowly started to get back into the movie making stuff, but it was really difficult to find people that wanted to do this stuff, even though everywhere there are, it just took me a while to find them. So I ended up reconnecting with my friend Donald Farmer, who, of course, is another movie maker who I've been tied with since 1986 when he was down in Florida and he used Mary Fanaro in Cannibal Hookers after I used her in Truth or Dare Critical Madness, as a matter of fact. So I used him. We did Dirty Cop 2. And from there, then I flew Joel up to do the next role because Kevin Lindemuth was making a sequel to the Alien Agenda called The Alien Conspiracy. So we shot that pretty much on my parents' land at the time. So again, I was just using locations that I had access to, flying people up, and then going from there. And then I connected with Professor Tredd, who was him and his partner had done, I don't know if you've heard of Brains on Film in Lexington. So yeah, they had a cable show in the 90s, which evolved into an internet show. So I started collaborating with him. And then later, Jacob Innes, who I ended up helping him get funding for a couple of his movies, Stash and something else that he was shooting in Lexington. And then eventually I connected with Claude Miles and a bunch of other people. And once again, just had a group of big people that I was able to draw from to continue to do stuff, starting with, well, I think we did Twisted Illusions 2. Then we did Reconcile, and then Deadly Dares, Truth or Dare Part 4, we did in 2012, 2011, somewhere in there, we shot those. So,
No, awesome. I mean, it is crazy because I mean, our whole crew would
it's
have
so insane.
absolutely wanted to be a part of something
Right.
back then. So somehow we didn't cross paths. When you were there, was the Cut Corner video store open, or had it already? It might already closed by then. It was in the basement of a record store.
Yeah, I think we filmed a scene in Twisted Illusions 2 in
Okay,
there, I believe. Yeah, it's close to
because
campus, right?
yeah. So there's
Mm-hmm.
so there was that, and then there was Voodoo Video. Which was also in a basement that our friend ran. But Cut Corner, like that was when I got there in 98, starting
It was the most exciting place.
because
It was
They were cool.
unbelievable. And just having all
Great,
that stuff
great movies.
that I'd read about it and wasn't available in my suburban town, that, oh my God, now I can see all these movies and rent them here. And just that whole just the culture of that. So it's crazy. And wait, what
It
was
was
the what's
quite
the burger
curated.
place that was by there that did move that we would Tally Ho,
Oh yeah,
the
Tally
burger.
Ho. Okay.
The burger. I mean, like
It was open 24
I
hours. You
guarantee
need
we
that
were like
place to.
in the same places, like at the
So
same
weird.
time, and somehow like it
Yeah,
just got.
somehow we didn't cross paths, but that
It's
would have been great
so.
to have you all in Twisted Illusions
Yeah,
2
I
or
mean, dude, yeah.
yeah.
Was Sharks of the Corn made there as well in Lexington, or
Yes, yeah, it was filmed in Jessamine County and in Lexington. Yes,
like no
so
shortage of corn, so that's good. Check, check.
once you get out in the country 5 or 10 miles, there's lots of corn stocks and lots of farmers. So
That's perfect. So what are you looking at now? Now you said Twisted Illusions 3 is on deck. Read an interview from maybe about a year ago that you said something that really hit us is that you were looking at making something inspired by one Mr. Jess Franco,
Oh
a
yes.
big favorite
Right.
in this household. Is that still something you're working on? What is in the mix right now for Tim Ritter?
Oh, well, again, I'm collaborating with Susanna Capistacci on a lot of stuff. She's helping with Twisted Illusions 3, which we hope to get back to very soon. I've been working on a couple of the scripts, and she's been working on a couple. And we've got Joel D. Weinkoop coming back to do one or two. So that's going to be cool. And then she's got another movie she wants to do called The Step Kid. and it's exactly what you think it would be.
All right.
The step kid, not the stepfather. Now we get to see the step kid, the little rampage there. So we've got that. And then the Jess Franco one, we started doing that during the COVID era because, it was so hard to do anything. So Shannon Stockin and Katrina and a couple other people were working with me. We have it all shot and it's all just being edited together. So that should be coming out probably next year, I would say. We'll have to see. But that movie's done shooting. It's just been in post-production. And I've now gotten in, as you know, from Sharks in the Corner, I've been doing a lot more music for my movies, which is exciting, because it's just having that John Carpenter, I guess, influence creativity that all of us had, it's now more than ever easier to sit down and try to learn something and create music. And you guys know all about that too as well. So just very fun, and you don't have to coordinate as many people and all that kind of stuff. So that I've been working on. As a matter of fact, I've been doing cues for future movies, just kind of building up a library of cool musical scores that we can hopefully draw from. And those are probably the biggest things. Is I think next week we have a showing of The Emasculator in Detroit in the theater because the distributor, Bloodsick Productions, that's the way they distribute movies now. A lot of video movies are now going to theaters and they're playing them there and selling copies afterward, as well as, the other traditional ways of selling Blu-rays on the internet and that sort of thing. So
Peter, we do have listeners in Michigan. Do you know what theater that will be at?
I'm not quite sure, but I can try to put it on my Facebook page or
Yeah,
something. Or I can shoot you
make sure.
guys yeah,
Yeah,
I'll
make
shoot
sure
you
to
guys.
look it up. Anyone listening who wants to go to that
I
in
think yeah, I
Detroit.
think it's next Friday. Go to Bloodsick Productions. Just type in Bloodsick Productions on the internet and it'll take you to their site. And I think that's where they're always shooting movies. They have Donald Farmer's latest movies,
Perfect.
and they're the ones representing the movie at this. I think it's a premiere of one of their new ones, and then Emasculator is going to play as a second bill. So
Perfect. Bloodsick
perfect.
Productions. Everyone just go look that up.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's been decades in the underground making these movies. What keeps you going? Is there just no, there's no stop? I mean, that's how we feel about everything we've done since we started doing everything from music to, now doing the podcast as well as obviously still doing music. What Just for us, there's no stop. There's nothing. It doesn't even, there's no crossing the mind that there's an option to stop. Is that how you operate?
Yes, it's pretty much it's the only time I feel really alive. So it's just the way I'm programmed, I think, and the way you all are programmed. So some of us, I mean, that's the hobby, that's the hope, that's just the reason we exist, other than trying to make ends meet somehow on the side or through this,
Just finances this.
Right?
Yeah. It's a means to an end, but yes, exactly.
Right.
Oh. No,
So
it's the only way to live. And it's just, again, it's just so, it's gotta be so cool that you made this Super 8 movie in high school for, whatever money you scraped together, dubbing it on, doing the sound on a boombox, and it's still getting out there. It's still getting issued. There's still people picking it up to this day, still discovering it, and then going from there to finding all these movies. It's just got to be.
I can't
It's
wait to hear your new soundtracks, the new sounds that you're
yeah.
Yes,
So
yes.
it's
Yes.
truly,
It's
yeah.
got
Yeah.
to be exciting just for you to not only have the history, continue looking forward to it, and just meeting all these people who are just still discovering your stuff. Yeah, it's very exciting and very rewarding, and it's always just great to, like one of my favorite movies is Wes Craven's Last House on the Left.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the reason why in a lot of the Jess Franco movies is because they're so handmade, they're so do-it-yourself, they're so backyard that you feel you can do that too. And when you look at some of my stuff, you're like, hey, I want to do that. and if this guy can do it, I know I've got a shot. I can do it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's probably what drives a lot of us and the why we create as well as, you know, absorb all this great material, old and new. You know, the newer stuff, it's harder to find stuff that you really connect with, I think, but there's a good mix and there is good stuff coming out. Just got to look for it a little harder, as you guys probably
Yeah.
feel the same way. And then when you find something older, that's always exciting too. Like, what was one? Candy Stripers or the Kidnap Co-Ed
This,
movies.
Peter
There's
Coyd,
always Vinegar Syndrome always has something
yeah, the
new.
Kidnap Coyd,
Axe, yeah, Axe.
yes.
Stephen Thrower's always
Oh,
finding movies like from Nightmare. What's that? The book that he wrote,
Nightmare
the
USA.
yeah, that's such a great book where you can
It's the
discover all these great movies that it might inspire you. You know, you got the coffee table book there
sitting
too.
right
Yeah,
here.
there it is. Yeah,
Bought it in
it's on my
Lexington.
coffee
Biggest
table
Christmas
too.
present.
Yeah. So yeah, we're definitely of the same mindset for sure. So yeah, I'm still, have you read that whole book? I'm still
You, I
reading.
mean,
I'm like,
I feel like I have, and then I'll open it and be like, oh, there's an entire, you know, we did an episode on the Black Room, and I was like, I remember that it was from that book that I had heard about the Black Room, but then I realized I'm like, I haven't gone back and read that article for since it probably came out, and we watched it, and then I went back and read it, and it was like even more mind-blowing,
It
and then
is.
reading more about
Have you
the
seen the
movies.
Black Room? Because look, we did this next to it. Wait, I think I can pick it up. Here, I'll turn this. We got the coffee table that glows from the
Oh
Black Room.
wow,
Yeah,
cool.
we're like,
Yeah,
we were
that's
inspired by the
awesome.
Black Room. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to watch the new. Didn't Vinegar Syndrome just release? Yeah, I haven't watched the new restoration, but
Oh,
I
it's.
saw it from the one of those old 25 movie DVD sets. That's what I saw it.
Yeah, it
Yeah.
looks so good. It
Yeah,
looks
yeah.
so
And
good.
that's the thing is these restorations, like we were talking about earlier. I mean, those were the way we saw so many movies. Like famously, one of our favorite movies, Messiah of Evil, was always released on one of those like eight movies at
At Circuit City,
actually
and you would get like an
the
eight
one that
pack.
we got has two of our all-time favorite movies, Christmas Evil and that. But I remember
Oh
watching those back then, being like, you can't even see, like you can
right.
barely
Oh,
see what's
they're
happening here.
pixelated and blurry,
And
and
then
you're
these
like, oh,
restorations, it's like, you
wait,
know,
that's an English torture dungeon? I had no idea.
you can see the movie now, but no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So no, it is exciting all this stuff that's coming out, and I'm so glad your movies are getting the respect that they deserve. Of course, like we said, you can pick up SRS Cinema that we've mentioned carries most of your movies. There's two box sets with the Shot on Video is one box set. The Truth or Dare series is another, and then some standalones. Tubi. Oh, you know, before I want to ask you, how does that work? How do you guys because how does the Tubi distribution work? Because there is an insane amount of Shot on Video. Todd Sheets,
We're
Polonia,
always
you
just
guys.
shocked
I'm
at what's
always
on
like,
Tubi. Like,
right.
the Night of the Zodiac movies
Yeah.
on Tubi. Like,
Right.
how do these movies get there?
They go through the distributors like SRS and WildEye and some of them that, and they sell the movies in packages. And of course, Tubi makes its money off of the ads. And I don't know if a lot of people don't know this, but Tubi is owned by Fox, who is owned by Disney. So all my movies and
Or
all these
Disney,
guys'
you
movies
know
are,
what?
but they make a fortune on those ads, evidently. And I was like,
Wow.
it's, but yeah, you have to, you know, go through an agent and they package them all up. And like you said, the wildest, even Jess Franco movies show up on there. And you're like, oh, wow, how did this get on here? You know?
It's we're always shocked, like how?
So it's good to
Yeah.
know that Disney is having a hand in distributing Dirty Cop. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. It's good.
So
Took
and
me a while, but
First Disney
evidently,
thing I've ever cared about.
yeah. Well, evidently, I read about it, and it's one of the most successful streaming models there is, and it's a very high kept secret because it's free to all of us. You're like, oh, it's just free, but I guess those ads send the money rolling.
Hey, it's hey, look. So there's a lot of ways to see Tubi. There's plenty of ways to see Tim Ritter movies if anyone listening has not. And if you have, you know how excited we've been to have this discussion, and just what a great time to go
Yes.
revisit some of your favorites. Tim, thank you so much for sitting down and taking the time to talk with us. This is so much fun.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure and honor to be here. Good luck with everything.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.